Like other residents of Paris, journalist, science writer Laura Spinney is holed up in her home. She's only able to venture out if she can produce an official certificate showing an approved reason for her journey. She's got a unique perspective on the current scenes of turmoil around the world. Her 2017 book, Pale Rider, covered the devastating impact of the 1918 influenza pandemic, which killed somewhere between 50 and 100 million people. And Laura Spinney joins me now on Skype, I hope. Hello, Laura.
Hello, Kim. How are you?
I'm reeking of hand sanitizer, but apart from that, I'm particularly well. How is Paris, please?
Paris is quiet. I just came away from my window because at 8 o'clock we have this little tradition that's 2 days old of applauding the medical staff working in our hospitals. And I can tell you that last night, which was pretty much the first night we did it, there were two people in my road clapping, so it was rather limp. But tonight there were a lot of people.
What, you mean that as they set off for work, you applaud them, or as they come back, you applaud them?
Well, no, because I'm on the other side of the planet from you, so it's evening here.
Yes.
And everybody is standing at their windows or on their balconies in the dark above the street lamps and applauding the doctors.
But where are the doctors? Are they going to work? Are they coming back from work? What are they doing?
I expect they are stuck in the hospitals dealing with the tumult.
Oh, I see. So this is a kind of symbolic applause. It's not like the doctors can hear them.
Yeah, I do. I think the Italians started it. I'm not entirely sure. But it's we didn't start it here. It's something that's kind of caught on around Europe. And I think the idea is just to say thank you. And if enough people do it around the city, then the doctors may hear it.
Good idea. You have to fill out a form if you want to go out.
Yeah.
And do you fill out a form and go out?
Oh, yeah, I do, because, and again, it's only day two, but my husband went out yesterday and he got checked. So it's a €135 fine if you're out without the form. I wish I had a dog, because that's one of the excuses you have to go out. but, you know, I mean, I think actually people are being, from what I can see from my little, you know, corner of Paris, people are being quite sensible. I've seen queues which are calm and 1 meter between each pair of people, people patiently waiting to go into the shop. No stockpiling. I mean, I think there has been, but I haven't seen it. And I think it kind of calms down as people realize what this thing really is and that it needs to be taken seriously.
I was wondering whether in France they panic bought, because I'm going to be talking to a psychologist later on about the psychology of pandemics. You might have some observations to make about that as well. But certainly in Australia and in Britain, and to a certain extent here, we've been panic buying.
I mean, I think there is some of it all over the place. I think there's partly a cultural element that, you know, I don't know, more individualistic societies might be more prone to it. But I actually think the stronger effect is how much the population has realized what is about to come. And I think that we're all on the same curve, basically, but we're at different points on it. And to make a kind of slightly profound point that I've been thinking about the last couple of days, our initial instinct was sort of to point back at the countries that were ahead of us on the curve and say, what did they do wrong? And then you realize, actually, we should have been learning from them. We should have been taking lessons from them, because we're going to be in exactly the same place soon.
That seems to be a prevailing message, that people are saying, look, China, the way it dealt with it, gave everybody else time that nobody else made good use of.
Yeah, I think so. And the Italians then were next, at least in Europe. And we haven't been really listening to them too. I mean, it's changing. But I wish that now, I mean, I'm British, but I live in Paris. I wish that the Brits and the Americans would be making a little bit better use of this time.
Well, they've suddenly cracked down. and we'll be talking. Yeah. We'll be talking about the UK shortly. Everything seems to have closed down. Boris Johnson has done a U-turn. Tell me how comparable this pandemic is to the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic.
So I get asked this question quite a lot lately. And it's quite funny because, you know, I wrote my book because everybody had forgotten about that disaster and now nobody can talk about anything else.
Yes.
But no, it's really interesting. I think it's fascinating that people are reaching for the worst possible historical reference. You know, I mean, because the Spanish flu was one of the worst, if not the worst, pandemics in human history, right up there with the Black Death of the 14th century. And we've had many others, and it's kind of in a league of its own. It was really, really bad. And I don't think that we need to compare this pandemic to that. I think that this one, and of course we're waiting for data to come in and we don't have the whole picture, but the picture is evolving. And based on what we've got so far, I think it's going to look more like the flu pandemic of 1957, which was the so-called Asian flu, or the one of 68, the so-called Hong Kong flu, which killed a lot of people, but many, many fewer. So for the Spanish flu, we say it killed at least 50 million people. Those are the most widely cited estimates today, maybe many more than that. The Asian flu of 1957 killed probably no more than 2 million people over a much bigger global population already. And 1968, the Hong Kong flu killed a few more, well, quite a lot more, but probably no more than 4 million people. So those are still big numbers, and they're vast compared to what we're looking at now in this pandemic, but they are still completely dwarfed by the Spanish flu.
And so we should not be reaching back that far to compare ourselves to that.
On the level of numbers, no, I don't think so. I think that's wrong. With the caveat again that we haven't got the full picture yet and that this virus could change. And we need to be very respectful and very cautious of it. But there are parallels that we can draw. There definitely are parallels we can draw. I mean, pandemics have certain things in common. And just to give an example, I mean, we don't yet have a vaccine for COVID-19. And we likely won't have one for a year or even 18 months. So that means that our best bet for slowing it down, limiting the number of sick people and dead people by slowing it down, and so relieving, spreading out the burden on our health systems, is what we call social distancing, all those methods that keep the sick and the healthy apart, and so slow down the transmission of the disease. Things like quarantine, self-isolation, masks, and hand washing. And those are the exact same techniques that they had 100 years ago. And in fact, that's all they had, because they didn't really know very much about viruses at the time. And so everything else they did was pretty ineffective in medical terms. So, and we're having many of the same debates. Talking about whether we should close schools or not, talking about do masks work, should you only wear them when you're symptomatic, or should you wear them all the time, all these things. And of course, it is a different virus, but they were the same discussions.
So do you think that an antiviral something or other might come in and serve in the meantime, until a vaccine can be up and running?
Well, we do have antiviral drugs. And my understanding of them, I'm not a doctor, but my understanding is that they're sort of moderately effective. I don't know that we have any that are tailored to this particular virus, but they're in the pipeline and people are working very hard to develop them. Well, we do have treatments. We have treatments that can mitigate the symptoms. The thing is that the vaccine is the only thing that can actually prevent people from getting sick in the first place. So we really don't have any at the moment that can, if you see what I mean. I mean, of course, in 80% world, and so from the picture we have today, it looks like the vast majority of people will be able to handle this at home like they handle a flu, even though it's a different disease from flu. And it's important to say that. Still, you know, there's that 10-15% of severe cases who need to be hospitalized, 5% of critical cases who may need to be ventilated. And that's if this virus intends to touch the entire global population and it's heading that way, it is very contagious. And that is a lot of people. Can you hear me?
Yes, no, I can. You're doing a kind of a Skypey noise, but you seem to be still with us.
Yeah, I think everyone's just piled on Netflix in my building.
Oh, what are they watching in France on Netflix?
I don't know, but when everybody's stuck at home, there's a lot of new burden on the internet, unfortunately.
When various people, such as the President of the United States, says, "We never saw this coming," do you kind of roll your eyes? Because scientists have been signalling that this will come forever.
Yeah, they have. And they've been saying there'll be another one, you know, this century, at least one. And the WHO has been, the poor maligned WHO has been telling us what to do in order to prepare for it. And we've been ignoring it very largely. You know, I mean, we do learn lessons after every epidemic or pandemic. We do take things on board and we do make advances. I mean, just to mention one very small example, there was a really interesting ranking that was published for the first time last October called the Global Health Security Index, which basically ranks all the countries in the world on their pandemic preparedness. And it tells you where each country is weak and where each country is strong. And no country is perfect, but every country can now see exactly where it needs to, you know, reinforce its, put resources in to make itself more robust in a situation like this. So that's an advance and it's hugely valuable. But I think that the consensus amongst public health experts is that we are not preparing to the extent that we should be, or as fast as we should be. We're not putting enough resources into it. And, you know, maybe that's partly because we've forgotten past experiences like this. We're being rudely reminded now, but, you know, we could do better.
All right. How long do you imagine, I mean, imagination is what we all have at this point. How long do you imagine your lockdown in France might last for?
My doctor friends who are working their socks off in the hospitals have been told that the peak is about 40, 50 days away. That's the peak. So we have to come down the other side. So it could be long.
So 40 to 50 days away, based on the numbers that are...
Based on the modelling. Yeah. All these epidemics follow a curve, basically.
Yep.
And that's what they're telling us now, based on the admittedly limited information they have about this virus, but it's getting better every day.
What's your take, Laura, by the way, on why Italy was so hard hit?
I think to a large extent it was random, to do with people flying in, flying out, just the connectedness of the globe. I don't think Italy did anything wrong, anything different. I honestly don't. I think mainly it comes down to chance.
They're in desperate plights at the moment, aren't they?
They are. Terrible stories coming from there. Yeah.
Very good to talk to you. I hope you stay well, and both physically and mentally, of course, as these things can take their toll on all of us.
And take care of yourself as well.
Thanks, Laura. Laura Spinney, who is the author of a book about the 1918 influenza pandemic called Pale Rider.